Hello everyone, my name is Jacob Minig, I'm the host of the Behavioral Health Integration Podcast. Today we have a very special guest, Amy Stewart. Amy is currently a graduate student at Wake Forest University. She just finished her first year, and she will explain to us how she became motivated to attempt to go to grad school and what that process looked like, and what motivated her to pursue this field. Again, I just want to let everyone know that this is the second part to the series, Becoming a Therapist. And without further ado, let's get started.
Amy, thank you so much for being on my show today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, so just looking up some of your information and from the times that we've talked previously, I see that mental health was not your first career choice, right? There was a different one prior.
Yeah, so I majored in justice studies when I did my undergraduate degree at Arizona State. Nice. And I did a few different things. I did some writing. I spent a summer working with adolescent girls coming out of the sex trafficking industry. I did a few different things, took some time off, cared for family. And then once my kids were a little bit older and I was ready to transition back into the workforce, mm-hmm. I realized that for what I really wanted to do, I needed a graduate level degree. And counseling had always been really interesting to me and had been something that I considered for many, many years. So I decided to go ahead and make the leap into the counseling field. And I love it so far.
Was there any particular moment that really inspired you to get into this field, or multiple moments?
I'm going to say multiple moments. So many, many years ago, back when I was a high school student, like I'd been a witness in a child abuse investigation. And you know what? It was, I don't want to say it was funny, because it was such a tough time for a lot of, for me, for my peers. But it was just interesting because to see the way that I responded to it, the way that my peers who were also involved responded to this investigation. And just that, not that it didn't impact me, but that I seemed to bounce back and some of my peers didn't. And like we were all impacted in different ways. And that was just interesting to me. And yeah, that really got me thinking about it a lot. And then following the birth of my second child, I had postpartum depression pretty severely. And I just realized, you know, it was time to get back to the workforce. And I was like, counseling has always been something that's been on my mind. And there have been so many little things that have, you know, happened throughout my life and that I've seen happen to others. And I thought, I want to be able to help other people sort through those sorts of things. I want people to be able to process through those things. And so I would say probably those two things were the biggest factors in me pursuing counseling.
Oh, definitely. I totally understand that too. And so when you took the leap, did you have any like worries or certain questions about like, oh, where should I go to school? What am I getting myself into? What program should I go and et cetera, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I did. So I think one of my concerns was, would I be taken seriously when I had been out of the workforce and out of academics for a little while? Like I have a big gap on my resume. I have to address that. Like I have an 8-year-old, a 6-year-old and a 2-year-old. So I've been home for a bit. And during that time at home, I certainly made sure to keep up with current events, listen to NPR, podcasted various series, yeah. Read. You know, I really ensured I was keeping my mind sharp so I could talk about, you know, more than how to change a diaper in 30 seconds. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, I have to account for that time. I have to account for that gap in my resume. Fortunately, I had kept up with volunteer work as well. I've been pretty involved in the local community. I had also been writing throughout that time also. Those all helped me. That made a big difference. But yeah, I had to find a program that would be understanding of that, that would be accommodating of that, that would appreciate that even if I had taken some time off, that I was nonetheless fully capable of completing a competitive program. And what it really came down to for me, I really loved Northwestern and I really loved Wake Forest. And both really incredible programs, KCREP accredited. That was a really big thing for me too. I wanted to ensure a program I went through was KCREP accredited. And, you know, they're both so wonderful. And I feel like any student looking to pursue a career in counseling could go to either one of those and do learn so much and do really fantastic. The reason that I opted for Wake Forest over Northwestern was largely because at the time, Northwestern University did not offer an asynchronous option. So essentially I would have had to log in at very specific times and, you know, listen to lectures and participate in class discussions. Wake Forest offered a little bit more flexibility. I could view lectures on my own time, office hours were recorded, et cetera, et cetera. And I would have to fly in a few times because I think they market the program as remote, but not necessarily online. So remote program, but there is some like some flying in that will be required. My first residency was performed virtually due to COVID rates at the time, but future residencies, I will need to fly a few thousand miles and get that done in person. But so that's why I had opted for Wake Forest, but I feel like both are very solid options. And like everyone I spoke to at both places was really wonderful.
So when you did the administration or interview to get into school, did any of this come up about like your long gap and whatnot when you do the interview?
It did. I felt like Northwestern and Wake responded, you know, in very helpful ways. There were other places I will leave unnamed where there were questions that I felt were inappropriate. I had questions, well, who are going to, like, who's going to take care of your kids? And how will you work childcare? Can you be a mom and complete this program? This is a tough program. Can you do both? And to me, I don't want to say that being a parent is irrelevant, but I am 100% fully capable of balancing the workload. And I'm very strategic about my time, very strategic about when I do my work. So there was some pushback from places. And from, it's my understanding that it is not technically illegal to ask that. They can't ask that. It puts them in a very tentative position.
I'm sorry. It sounds very sexist, to be honest with you. And I could be, I could be wrong, but I'm just going to say it right now. Would they have said that to a man with a family?
I really want to get down to it. I honestly don't know. And I never want to be like, oh, woe is me. It's because I'm a woman. It's because I'm a mom. But at the same time, I do wonder, it's hard not to wonder. That did not come up at Wake Forest or at Northwestern. And at least at Wake Forest, I can say that there are some professors during their office hours, they've had a kid run in, you know, interrupt a session and they address it, they move on, it, you know, it's fine. And, I actually love to see that because I feel like it normalizes the fact that someone can be a working professional, very competent in their field, well-versed, knowledgeable, and they have a family and they're able to balance that appropriately. And, so I am for a long time, like I was just very tentative about, man, how do I even handle this? I tried to even avoid talking about being a stay-at-home parent. And, there was a season two that when I would get asked that question about the gap in my resume, I kind of switched it up a little bit and I'd say, I took time off to care for family. And, that was another kind of technique of mine. Some people are opposed to that because they really want to know up front, is this a place that is going to be understanding and respectful of parents who are transitioning into either academic life or work life again? And it's like seeing the red flags up front, like that can be helpful. But for me, I was like, look, I'm just going to say I took time off to care for family. That's technically true. And if I end up going with a place that they're unaware I have children or whatever the case may be, like they'll find out eventually, but they'll find out after I've gotten, you know, 100% on tests, things like that. But Wake Forest knows I have kids. They know I have a family, and I have a 4.0. So, you know, like I'm getting it done, and I hope to be just one of many, many people returning to the workforce after some time as a stay-at-home parent and showing others like, look, this can be done and you can do it. It does take support, but yeah, it can absolutely be done.
Well, you know, the funny thing is all around the country, counseling at the master level seems to be like a second career for a lot of people, to be honest with you.
Yes. Yeah. There are so many people in my cohort. I really thought I would, because I'm 36. So I really thought I would be, you know, the old fogey in the program. Like I'd be with all these whippersnappers, and I'm really not. I think I don't think I'm one of the youngest, but I think probably the majority in my program are the same age or older. And there are a couple who are coming out in right after their undergrad, but for the most part, I think there are some, like it's mostly like late 20s, early 30s. And then we have some people who are like 70s. So.
Well, yeah, it's funny because when I started, I was 30 and I was, again, more kind of like in the middle. But yeah, you'd see some that are fresh out of undergrad, and then you'd see again some who were more 45, 50. I mean, I even had a classmate that was a former chiropractor.
Oh, well, you know, that's everything.
And also another one was a former lawyer too. So they come from everywhere. Oh,
yeah. Yeah. I think so. Gosh, there's such a huge, the diversity is amazing. There's, I've seen some people from social services, from teaching. A lot of the people in teaching are going like the school counseling route, huge need for that, of course. I do think there is an attorney in my cohort, a woman from the military. Gosh, who else? Like it's all over the place. MBAs. Oh, there's someone who's a professor somewhere else. I'm like, I don't know how she does it. Like she's a professor. She's teaching something else at a different university. I'm like, oh my goodness. She must have like amazing time management skills, but she gets it done. So yeah, very diverse in terms of where people are coming from. And yeah, I would say a very popular choice for second career.
So were you ever worried about, again, what program to choose? Because I know when I got started, I was very naive to the different types of, I guess, careers, where I was originally just thinking of getting my master's in addiction counseling. But one of the school people told me, well, you know, there's a co-occurring program. I'm like, what the heck is co-occurring? They're like, well, that's just mental health and addiction. I'm like, oh, sweet. I'll go for that. Were you ever concerned about, hey, should I go like the LMFT route, the social worker route, et cetera?
I don't think that was as much on my mind as it was, let me see, let me investigate a few different schools. And I knew I wanted to do some sort of counseling in mental health. But I didn't know exactly what, and that's still something I'm very open to. I have areas where I have more experience. I have areas that I find more interesting, but I am keeping an open mind about what the future holds in that regard. But I think I was more interested in a program that had a, was rigorous, was well-respected, that the school had a long history and a good reputation. And I just really, both Northwestern and Wake Forest checked all the boxes there. And the programs they offered, well, I'll speak at least for Wake Forest because I don't remember specifically what Northwestern was offering, but at least for Wake Forest Licensed Professional Counseling, so LPC. And so I was like, okay, that I love the program. I read all about it. Everyone I talked to from the school was really wonderful, and it was very informative. And I was like, all right, LPC it is. So here we go. But I have to say, so I'm being open-minded, but I will probably not do school counseling.
Oh yeah. Yeah. My grad school had that too. We had like the school counseling, the LMFT mental health, or the mental health addiction route. So
yeah. And I did sign a contract for my practicum will be at a facility that does both inpatient and outpatient treatment for people with alcohol and or substance abuse. So, I mean, that's not technically a credential in like addiction specifically, but I'll at least get some knowledge and some experience in that particular area.
Just curious, in the state of Arizona, is an addiction counselor a licensed profession or a certificate?
You know what? That's a really good question. And I will have to research that and get back to you. I want to say it's a certificate, but don't quote me.
Okay. No, yeah, just curious because it's pretty interesting on how like every state is just different and like credentialing, licensing, and how to get there.
Yes. There are so many different acronyms at this point. I'm like, it's so confusing. Tons of acronyms everywhere.
So when you said rigorous, when it comes to grad school, rigorous as in, is it more of an accelerated program that gets you out of there quicker or just the workload's pretty high?
When I say rigorous, what I'm thinking of is a program that is going to challenge its students to think critically and to engage the material in a way that is very interactive and to press back on maybe some previously held convictions and just like, let's look at these with fresh eyes. Here's information. This is, you know, the field, this is what we're studying, this is what we're looking at, let's press into this. But yes, just like really that critical thought process, I think is so important. Because I've seen so many people who are very well educated and yet misinformed or spreading incorrect information. And this is something else I did ages ago, but I know during my undergraduate career, I spent a long time tutoring writing and I would see PhD students even come in with these papers and their dissertations and they're so knowledgeable and it's so incredible, but like sometimes they would quote something in their paper and these little alarm bells would go off and I'd be like, I think we need to research that a little bit more.
Don't get me started on my thesis. I loved it, but it took me so long because I'm not a grammar person and my citations were off a little bit.
I have to say, I mean, I love writing and I'm a pretty fast writer and a fast reader, which I think is why I have been able to do well in the program. But, APA citations, man, it's tough. I have just kind of accepted at this point, like with my citations, I'm probably going to place a period in the wrong place or something. I'm going to mess it up somehow, but, I guess I'm thinking more of, just really like having a good eye for like critically engaging material and like researching and looking for credible sources and the significance of that, but which I thought like Wake did very well. Like before we even started the program, they had all of our cohort kind of go through here, look at all these different sources. Is this a credible source? Like, is this a peer reviewed source? Is this something that, is maybe good for like a lay person to learn a little bit more about a topic, but you wouldn't necessarily use it if you were citing it for an academic paper. But I think that's really critical too, because I just see so much misinformation everywhere. Mm-hmm. And I just think it's really critical for us to not just be educated, but to really learn to investigate, fact check. Is this quote accurate? Did this person say this? Mm-hmm. Okay. This person says they're a doctor of what? That sort of thing. I could do a TED talk on that, but I'll stop there.
Can I tell? I like where we're going with this because I want to tell you like a horror story. I won't get too deep into it.
Okay.
But when I was doing my thesis, again, I loved the lady at the writing center that I just would work with on my thesis and everything. She was amazing. And she was looking at my thesis and everything when I got going on. I think it was like the first few chapters of it or the sections. And she looks at it and she's just like, Jake, do you understand APA? I'm like, yeah, I cite the person and I try to put the sentence in my own words. She's like, yeah, but Jake, you can only use like Well, what is it, like one or two of your own words or vice versa, and that's it. Yeah. And I guess I was using too many of the author's words in a sentence.
Oh.
She's like, Jake, and again, I switched what do you call them? The people that help you with your thesis, let's say. And I switched to a different guy, but she's like, again, I'm kind of painting a negative picture on this other person, but she's like, if so-and-so, like your old person that was working on your thesis, let's say, got a hold of this, you'd be kicked out of college. Like you'd be kicked out of grad school and you wouldn't.
Yeah.
Because it's plagiarism.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I was just trying to express myself. Like I did not know that. I mean, I thought you put in your own words and then you give the person credit. She's like, yeah, but you use too many of their words. You can only use, I think you can only use like one or two in a sentence, I believe.
Yeah, I don't know exactly what it comes down to, but I have a feeling she might have been trying to get across to the importance of, okay, so this is what this person said. What do you think about it? Mm-hmm. And what are its implications? And like, how does that apply? Like, what are your thoughts on it? Because you can't just regurgitate what another author says. Like, we have to have our own, right? We're interpreting the information this way and we're communicating it to other people. Here are our thoughts. Here are the implications we think it has for this issue or another. But yeah, citing citations, it's really tough. And yeah, I don't blame anyone for being confused. It's my least favorite part of writing. I'll say that. Although most of what I do is nonfiction right now and very academic. So I kind of have to, but it's no fun. And I've just kind of accepted that if I'm writing something for a class, I'm probably going to get docked like one or two points for APA because I'll have put a period in the wrong place or something like that. And you know what, as long as I still get an A on the paper, I'm okay with it. I'm just going to live with it.
Oh yeah. Yeah. So when it comes to like workload, were you kind of just curious about what it was going to be like? Cause I know that was one of my biggest fears in starting grad school is like, oh my God, can I handle the load? Or I looked at the syllabus and it says we need to do like 30 pages of reading per day for this class and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that was definitely on my mind, especially because I did not want to put my family on the back burner. So there was definitely that sense of urgency on my part to make sure that I prioritized correctly, and that I wanted to perform at a certain level academically, and I did not want that to come at a cost for the way that I cared for my family. I actually have a kind of funny story about that. I've told it a few times. It's kind of embarrassing, but my mission was I don't want to do any schoolwork in front of my kids because I want them to understand that they're my priority. Okay. And then my daughter, who was maybe four at the time, did an impression of me. And her impression of me was, oh, I'm mom and I'm so beautiful, but I only do boring things like housework or dishes. And I was like, okay, first of all, I do a lot of fun stuff. I just do it when you guys are in bed because like I have to take care of you guys. And yeah, someone's got to do this housework. But I realized there's actually an important, I think there's importance in letting your kids see that you have, you know, responsibilities and seeing their parents work on things to a certain degree. And so at that point, I kind of changed things up a little bit. And I did do some work while my kids were around. I would do readings or maybe like a discussion board post or something like that. I couldn't do in-depth research or in-depth writing because just the attention span needed to do that kind of work. I can't do that when I have, you know, someone who wants me to turn on Bluey for them or something. Though that's a great show. So like there was kind of a balance that I needed to strike, like how much work will I do when they're present versus how can I show them that they're valued, that they are my first priority. So it was tricky for me. And you know what works for my family might be very different than, you know, what works for another family. For the most part, my work is done after my kids are in bed, but my kids are sleepyheads. They're in bed by 7:30. So I have plenty of time to do that work. Also with Wake Forest, the classes are condensed into 7 weeks, I believe, but it is one course at a time. So all the attention can be focused on that one course, which I think is fantastic. Mm-hmm. And I really think it's probably one of the reasons that I managed to thrive in this program is because I can really zero in on a particular topic and I don't have to divide my attention between like research and statistics. And now I'm like switching gears and going into group therapy. So being not having to kind of juggle multiple topics and figure out what's going on with which class, like I don't mind doing a ton of work in a short amount of time if it's on the same topic. That makes things a little bit easier for me, actually.
Good. No, I sense a real happiness in you. Like you made the right choice, right? In your head right now.
I think so.
There's peace to that. There's really a lot of peace, peace of mind to that.
Yes, I agree. I'm very excited to continue to learn, to continue to develop in my skill set, and then actually apply that to people who like need to work through things, who need to talk through things. And like we take care of our bodies, we take care of our minds. And I'm glad to be able to learn to help people who are really struggling maybe with something in terms of mental health and talk through some things. So yeah, I definitely have a lot of peace about it. And I'm so excited to be able to continue to help people for sure.
Well, good for you. And I'm just curious. So is your program 2 years long?
It is 3 years, because 3 years, and that includes a practicum and two internships and two residencies. So, there's a lot. There's a lot, but it's good.
Okay. No, that's good. That's great. And, just right about like, what were some of your favorite classes after your first year?
Wow, I feel like I've loved everything but statistics. So.
Yeah, I remember you saying that. Research, right? Yeah.
Statistics and research, yeah. That one was tough, but there was someone that I knew who had tutored like math and statistics and stuff. And I knew that he would have gotten an A in the class. And I was like, well, if he can get an A in the class, I can get an A in the class. Yeah. But so that I use my competitive drive to be able to survive that class. Mm-hmm. Besides that, I want to say, I think my favorite class might've been group work and group theory. I think it's really interesting because we get to see the perspective, not just of the counselor, but then you have people interacting with each other and you have the perspective of the counselor or the psychotherapist or whomever. And then you have the input from your peers as well. Yes. During that class, we read through, Dr. Irvin Yalom, the Schopenhauer Cure?
Yep. I got the same book. Yep.
And so we read through the Schopenhauer Cure and very interesting book and like a very readable, surprised at what a fast read it was, but that was interesting too. I know, some people have concerns about some of the way things are depicted, but nonetheless, some of the things that were helpful for me, just seeing the way that people who are not counselors, but nonetheless participants in the group are helping each other by talking through things and communicating their perspective on things and kind of pushing back when there's tension in the group and using that tension to flush out issues. So that's just really interesting. Although I have to admit, I'm kind of conflict averse. So I'm going to have to learn to get over that if I'm going to do well in that area.
Well, the one negative issue I've heard about Yalom and his book is that it's not very realistic because in the book, and again, a lot of professionals do this, like when they have their practice, right, and they're doing group therapy, they choose what kind of clients they want to be in the groups. And they just take some clients and be like, hey, I'm not a good fit for you. And they refer them somewhere else. So it's not very realistic in a lot of the different types of like work avenues, like the treatment center setting, especially in Minnesota. So if you go to the LADC route, you're going to be doing tons and tons of groups with all different types of clients with a lot of trauma, a lot of mental health issues and addiction issues. So again, it makes it a lot harder to apply those group theories. It's not impossible, but it's just more difficult. And again, it would just be a lot easier if you could just pick what clients you want to be in your groups.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think a couple of my cohort had been concerned about the way sexual trauma was represented. Okay. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I feel like every book you read, there's going to be some element. You're just going to have to take it with a grain of salt. Yep. But for me, it was at least interesting because I had really zero context for what group mm-hmm. therapy was like beyond my textbook. And so it was my first exposure to what at least it could look like mm-hmm. in a fictional representation. But I'm going to say, yeah, to answer go back to your question, group therapy has probably been my most interesting class thus far. And it's something that I look forward to learning more about too, because I also really love the idea you're helping so many people. Well, let's say like you have a group of like 7 or 8. Yep. So you get to help 7 or 8 people at once. And yep. so you're kind of maximizing the impact in a minimal amount of time. Of course, there's like outside prep and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But I just thought that was a really cool, a cool aspect of it as well.
Yeah, it really is. It really is. And there's a lot to, I guess, learn about theories and like the different types of clients too. Like each client mm-hmm. plays a role, kind of like a family systems theory.
Yeah.
So have you taken a theories class yet?
Yes, that was my first class, if I recall correctly.
So is there any particular styles or theories that you like right now that you might want to put in your toolbox as a therapist?
Okay, so I feel like this is such an easy out of an answer, but I'm going to say I want an eclectic approach. So, okay. And again, I feel like that's the kind of thing that someone says when they don't want to pick just one particular yeah. approach, but it just seems to me, and I realize that I'm still learning and have a lot to learn, mm-hmm. But it just seems to me that there are certain situations in which one particular approach might be really beneficial. And then there might be mm-hmm. other situations in which that is a less helpful approach.
Right.
And so my suspicion is, and you know, we'll see once I am actually seeing clients, but I have a feeling I will kind of want to just play it by ear and see like what's going to be helpful for this particular client, what's going to be helpful for this particular scenario. Mm-hmm. I know person-centered is obviously really huge.
I so thought you were going to say that. I thought that was going to be your first answer out of that.
So I do love person-centered.
Me too. Yeah.
And who doesn't love person-centered? I mean, I'm sure there are people who don't, but
yeah,
it's just a very popular approach. I do like that. I would also say that there have been things that I've read about narrative therapy or reality therapy that I have felt like could resonate with a client depending on what the situation is. And also depending on the client temperament, not just what they've gone through, but what is this client's personality like? What are their strengths? What are their weaknesses? What will really click for them? Mm-hmm. And I'm really hoping that I can develop a few different approaches that will be really helpful for the kind of clients that I end up seeing. And again, I don't know just yet what kind of clients those will be. Right now, most of my experience is in perinatal mental health. I have a little bit of experience in issues of emotional dysregulation, addiction, mental health, and addiction and or substance abuse. But I feel like so much depends just on what does this client need, what is the situation. So we'll have to see as I learn more and get more into it, what I end up doing, but that's my hunch so far.
Yeah. And as you grow as a therapist, like when you graduate and you start practicing, mm-hmm. you'll find your niche and you'll get into like specializations, like again, substance abuse, you'll learn mm-hmm. about trauma therapies. And if you want to go that route, yeah. you can specialize in that. And so, mm-hmm. forth.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, now I want to get to the juicy parts of the
Okay.
Well, practicums, your internship, right? I know you were mm-hmm. Very curious about that prior, mm-hmm. right? And red flags, and I'm so glad that you asked me that question, because these are a lot of things I learned too when I was a student. Are okay, what are the red flags? What should you look for in an internship, and etc. And you did say that some people did reach out to you and give you some advice on that.
Yeah.
Do you feel comfortable saying some of that stuff?
Right. So here, let me think. What was the most helpful stuff? I'm trying to think of what was most helpful, because I had probably like 3 or 4 people who I really respected get back to me. And I'm trying to think what was most beneficial to me when I was initially reading it. I think probably some of the most useful feedback that I got was from one individual. He had his doctorate, so he was, done everything. But he really talked a lot about just like even the interview process and treating it as a job interview. Because a lot of people, I think, are thrown by the fact that like, oh, it's practicum or it's internship. So even though I have interview experience or I've interviewed for jobs before, I haven't interviewed for a practicum or I haven't interviewed for an internship, but there is a lot of overlap. And a lot of the tips that are useful for interviewing are also really beneficial for in the interviewing process for practicum and internship. And again, like I've signed a contract on my practicum, I haven't signed a contract on my internship yet, so I can't speak to that portion, but I will at least say that I agree on the practicum portion. And another resource too that I would point people to, just as a general rule, I think Allison Green, who authors the Ask a Manager column, she's been featured in a few different publications and she has a couple books out, but she has a ton of interviewing tips. It's not specific to practicum and internships. It's more general than that, but she has a lot of very useful feedback on her website. And I utilized her as a resource too. But I'm going to say she, and then a couple of the people that I reached out to via LinkedIn, just regarding some tips about that process, treating it as an interview and understanding how to, you know, relate to your interviewer and prepare. But I felt like there was a lot of overlap between general interviews for, you know, a job interview and then actually interviewing for practicum.
You know, and I just want to add one really important thing too, that one of my professors said at the end of my first year, is as a student, you need to understand when you go into the interview that you have control and you have some power, because a lot of the time students will just grovel and just take the first internship that accepts them. Where my professor is trying to explain to us is that if you don't like it, or if it's just not a good interview, again, like you take it like a job interview, if you're getting some bad vibes and you're not feeling it, say no, because you're going to have other options, and they need you almost more than you need them, in a sense. So know that you have value.
Yes. No, I agree. And I mean, I would say the same thing to anyone with a job interviewing. It's a mutual thing. There's a mutual interviewing. They're interviewing you and you're also interviewing them and determining, is this a good fit?
Yep. And also, I think you have to look at the student too. And as you know already, like everybody's in different situations in life. Some people are married, some people are not, some have kids, some don't. So some may be looking at other aspects of an internship, like pay. Some are paid, some are not. And okay, well, money's tight. And if I can learn and get paid, that might be a good idea for me. So some will pursue that route.
Yeah. And I do think that some people in my cohort are already working at some sort of behavioral facility and are exploring the possibility of actually doing their practicum and or internship at that same facility.
Okay.
So I think that that's something that has to be cleared by the university. But that's a possibility as well.
So you guys have internships and practicums, right?
Yes.
So we're on the same page. Could a student choose to do both at one site if they wanted to?
Yes. And I could have requested that my contract be for my practicum And if I'm understanding this correctly, my practicum and both internships, like I could have just been like, let's sign a contract for everything. But I really want to diversify my skill set. I have so much that I've already done in perinatal mental health. So I was kind of trying to stay away from that area. I love it. It's interesting to me. And I'm passionate about it, but I want to do so much more. And so I was like, let me check out addiction and substance abuse. There was someone else who had reached out to me too about the possibility of doing some work with MD students, because there are universities, medical universities, universities who are concerned about their PhD students and the mental health of these students. Very high pressure fields. There are a lot of students who are, you know, fresh MDs, and you know, they're seeing people die for the first time, and especially, you know, in a pandemic, just the death, the stress, and these universities, and they want to take care of their students, and they're seeing so much pressure. And so someone had reached out to me about the possibility of working in that too. And that's definitely something I consider for the future also. But there are a lot of really great areas out there, but me wanting to diversify, that was the reason I was like, let's just do my practicum, worry about that for right now. I'd like at least the option of exploring having internships elsewhere. If I love where I do my practicum and I just can't imagine doing my internships anywhere else, then I can, you know, do another contract. And of course, assuming that feeling is mutual, I sure hope they like me. But I just wanted the option though to let me have a little bit more flexibility there. So I'm signing on for my practicum only. And then if it goes really well and I just love it and don't want to leave, then I can, or we can go ahead and consider doing my internships there also. But I also have the option of exploring internship opportunities elsewhere.
Well, and again, I think that's a great idea too, just because we're talking about red flags. And I kind of had an experience where it wasn't the best one, where again, I just took the first internship that came my way. And I don't know about you guys, but ours was more of like an hour requirement. So we had like the internship practicum. And I think overall you need roughly like 800 hours for the program. So the first one was 100 that we had to do. And then the second one was the long one, which was 700.
Okay.
Are you guys similar to that as well? In a sense?
You know what? I have a sheet of like a PDF, I think, like a sheet of paper that I printed in a PDF somewhere on my computer with all that information. I don't remember the exact numbers, but I want to say that at least the practicum is 150 hours.
Okay.
And that's the shortest one.
Yep.
And then the internships are substantially longer.
Yeah. Yep. And again, things could happen. Like you could think that your first site is great. Like the interview went well, just like me, you get along with the person. And then when you actually start doing it, you just, you know what I mean? You get a funny feeling in your gut, like this isn't right. Something's wrong here, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And
for me, again, that's the decision I kind of made, where it's like, I did my 100, then I left to a different one. And again, for me, that was the best decision I could have made for my career.
Okay, that's good for me to know. I'll keep that in mind. It'll be interesting to see what happens with my practicum. I'm definitely looking forward to it. And the person supervising me seems competent, like very informed, really lovely. But you're right, anything could happen. And I just want to keep my options open. And then, just be willing also to consider what other opportunities might come my way, because I feel like everyone in the counseling field is so helpful, and it's so easy to network in the counseling field, because people don't go into counseling if they don't want to be helpful to other people. And so there are always so many people who are willing to like use their own connections to help you out. And so I think that there are a lot of opportunities out there. And again, it is, I think at least it's very important to just have a very diverse skill set. And there will be things that I'm naturally better at and things where I tend to find a little bit more challenging, but I want a lot of experience in a lot of different areas. And so just having that option, that's what is critical to me.
Oh, absolutely. And just from my experience too, working with my fellow intern students, like another issue they kind of ran across, and maybe you've heard of this too, is the lack of hours you might get seeing like mental health clients and how you need a certain amount.
Yes. Yes. I've heard horror stories about that. So I'll keep you posted. Yeah, I have not yet started my practicum, so I'm not sure what that will look like yet for me, because yes, there are some, it's like this number of hours, like direct work, this many hours, this sort of work. Yep. So it's all listed out on DocuSign. I had to sign it. My site had to sign it. But I have heard of that happening. And so that's something I want to be mindful of too. But I, from my communications with the person who will be supervising me, I'm fairly optimistic about how well it will go. And hopefully that optimism is not misplaced, but I have a good feeling. I'll say that.
Now, again, you're going to be working at a treatment center, you said?
Yes. So if I'm remembering correctly, they offer both inpatient and outpatient services to people who have a history of issues with alcohol or some other substance. But I think my emphasis, it's my understanding that I'll be focusing on the people who are there for their in-treatment, their in-treatment program, inpatient program, excuse me.
So from my experience, when I switched from, I guess my first one was at a high school center. Yeah, it was like a therapy center in the high school and everything. So from there, I switched to an intensive outpatient treatment center. And just so you know, I had no problem getting clients in their hours and whatnot. So the fact that I heard you saying like substance abuse treatment, I'm like, oh, wow. Okay. She's going to be good then.
Okay.
In my experience, I think you're not going to have any issue finding clients in hours.
All right. All right. That's good. Okay. That goes along with like my gut feeling, but gut feelings can be wrong sometimes. So you never know.
But again, to my listeners, again, that's through my experience. It might not be the same for you. So I don't want to get your hopes up, but yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, I will remain cautiously optimistic, but I'll keep you posted. And I'm looking forward to it, and I think it will work out well, but I always want to be mindful of, you know, other options, other, you know, fallback things to fall back on. But I also feel like the support system that I even have through Wake Forest University is pretty incredible. So keeping my faculty in the loop and my advisors in the loop, I know that they have my back if something goes wrong too. They've been pretty clear about that. They're here to support us, and I definitely feel really well supported by them.
Well, that's great. And again, that's so important for a student success, especially in grad school, you know? It's a powerful thing. And so just, I got to ask you this though, like, has anyone tried to steer you away from the mental health field?
You know what? I feel like most people have been incredibly supportive. I think especially with the pandemic, there has been a lot more awareness about the need for good mental health support. And good counselors, good therapists. So I can't really think of anyone who's tried to steer me away from it. And I think most people who know me and know my personality know this is just like, I want to be helpful. I want to be involved. I love helping the community. I love like volunteering and caring for other people. This is very much up my alley. And so I think the people who know me understand this is what helps me feel fulfilled. This is what I think is a good use of my time. I think it's the best way to support people around me. I feel like I come from a lot of privilege. I feel like I have had resources that other people haven't had. And I really want to make sure that I can give back to my community. Like I didn't choose to be born in the family that I was born into, and they equipped me well and set me up for a lot of success, and a lot of people didn't have that. And so I want to be able to be be able to use my own resources to help other people. And I think the people closest to me have understood that and have respected that and thought that I was well suited for this career path. So fortunately, that has not been an issue. I haven't experienced anyone trying to dissuade me in that. But maybe I only know really amazing people. So I don't know.
Well, you're off to a good start, I'll tell you that. Yeah. Well, a lot of people put a lot of focus on like the process of becoming a therapist. And again, all states are different, where I don't know what it's like for Arizona, but I know for Minnesota, like once you graduate, that's more just half the battle, because you need to get your supervision hours for licensure. And for us, it's 4,000. So that's equivalent to like 2 years after you graduate. And again, I'm not sure what it's like for you guys down there.
Yeah, I want to say it's something similar. I don't recall the exact figures off the top of my head, but I know that it is a lot. And that was one of the things that was a little bit disheartening, because I mean, I'm not 22 anymore, but at the same time, I was like, well, like at the time, I think it was that I was interviewing schools. I want to say I was 33 and I was like, well, either way, I'm going to be 40 one day, like either way, I'll be 40 someday. So I can either be 40 and have gotten my graduate degree and potentially a PhD at that point and be helping other people, or I can be 40 and not have done that. Like either way, I'll probably be 40 unless I meet some sort of untimely demise. So like either way, I'm going to get older. So do I want to do this or not? And I was like, okay, yeah, I want to do this. And, like, even though I'm, you know, getting increasingly old and decrepit, nonetheless, like I still have a fair amount of energy and I want to keep working and keep helping people for as long as I possibly can. And, so I'm glad to do that, even if it takes me a long time, even if there are a lot of hours involved. I concur with your assessment that just getting the graduate work completed, getting the master's done is probably the biggest battle. But even when it comes to hours towards licensure, like, well, I get to help people while I'm working towards that. And either way, I'm going to get old someday. So I might as well get old while I'm helping people. So that's my mindset.
Well, and that's one of my biggest pet peeves in this field, is that, again, they make it extremely difficult for people to, again, get through graduate school, which is a triumph in itself, I'll tell you what. And then to say, hey, you need to do 2 more years supervision and you got to pay for that supervision just to get licensed. It's just, it's a lot of money. It's a lot of effort spent. And they did like a study on a lot of, I don't know the exact numbers, but like so many like therapists do not even get to become licensed because they just can't take it anymore. They just end up dropping out because it's just, it's a lot of work and a lot of money.
I mean, I don't have the access to the numbers or the data that you are looking at, but I'll take you at your word. And I agree. Like, I mean, there are some members of my cohort who are already feeling the pressure, feeling burned out. It's a lot of reading. It's a lot of writing. I think it has worked out well for me. And I don't want to say that I'm not challenged. I am challenged, but I think that like it's worked out as well as it has for me because I'm a really fast reader and a fast writer. So that has really been a huge advantage for me. And just in genuinely enjoying it, I find it very refreshing to do it. It also, I mean, I will say, so I don't see clients, but I do mentor through Postpartum Support International. And there are some people that I have mentored that like it, they aren't clients. I want to be clear on that. They're mentees, but, and there are some who are not, no one's in crisis. They wouldn't be accepted into the mentee mentor program through PSI otherwise. So they're all in recovery, and some of them they are in varying degrees of wellness. So some are pretty much like 100% well. They just want a little bit of support as they're transitioning with, you know, a newborn or whatever the case is. And then there are some who have higher needs, and then Some of those higher need mentees do, at least for me, tax some of my emotional reserves a little bit more. Mm-hmm. Nonetheless, like I have found it still, as long as I maintain appropriate boundaries, and yeah. I think thus far I've done a really good job of maintaining and cultivating those boundaries. I think that's one of the things that has protected me from burnout. Because I have gotten sometimes occasional, you know, 11 p.m. text messages from a mentee, like, can we talk immediately? And being okay with saying no, and that's not something that I can do at this moment. And I would, you know, it's not a crisis issue. These are not people in crisis, and that's not my role. Just adhering to appropriate boundaries and being okay with some potentially passive aggressive responses, maybe, but just being okay with that. Like, okay, they're upset that I can't talk at 11 PM at night, and that's just how it goes. But you know what? Like, they have gotten over it and they've bounced back. They didn't fire me as a mentor. We worked through it. But I think just having those boundaries, that's been really helpful as well. But I also don't want to be naive, because I'm still fairly inexperienced in this field. I'm still fairly new to it. But I'm hoping that some of the other skills that I've picked up along the way to this point in my life will also help protect me from that potential fallout and those disadvantages there.
No, I like what you said, because again, setting those boundaries and becoming like very good at that is going to help you so much down the road as a therapist. Like, not only like with your clients, but like with your fellow peers or some family members, etc. You know, it's going to really help with your stress levels.
Yeah, that's what I'm learning, because I think I'm just very approachable. And I try to be very warm and like approachable and friendly. And so it's not atypical for, you know, me to meet someone and for them to find out that I'm working for its licensure, and then have them say, oh, okay, well, I'm bipolar, and then my two kids are bipolar too. And or for someone to, you know, cold message me on LinkedIn and ask for like some sort of therapeutic service, which, you know, like A, I'm not licensed, and B, LinkedIn is not set up for that. You know, like setting the boundary right there. And if it's someone in person, just being like, okay, well, I will get you, you know, I have some great referrals for you. Or if it's on LinkedIn, I pretty much, I'm like, hey, I will get you a good referral. If you think you're a danger to yourself or just someone else, I urge you to call 911. And otherwise, here's some resources for you. And, but yeah, using that to establish some boundaries, because some people will reach out and it's like a cold reach out via LinkedIn or whatever the case is, or it's just someone you met in person and they know you're in that field. And so they'll ask for you to consider taking them on as a client. And I'm already quite cognizant of the dangers of dual relationships, so I definitely want to avoid that. And I have my that in my back pocket, just being like, oh, I'll get you a referral. And I have plenty of referrals, so that's not an empty promise. I will do that. But I am very protective of those boundaries.
You know, I love how you mentioned boundaries in social media. I just remember like listening to like another podcast too about like even like Facebook, Instagram, and how clients will look for you and try to add you on as a friend on those sites.
I actually, that's funny you mentioned that. I just deleted my Facebook account like morning. Yeah. I'm like, let me get ahead of it. I'm going into practicum. I hardly ever use Facebook anyway, so let me just delete it. For now, I still have my Instagram account, but I have like so few connections on there. But that's exactly what I don't want. I don't want to pop up for someone else as a recommended friend. And I mean, I had pictures of my family on there, and I want to make sure that I'm protecting them and their privacy and their autonomy as well. So that was also something I considered. So for right now, I have LinkedIn, and that's been a really useful tool for me, especially again, being a stay-at-home parent and transitioning back into the workforce and just developing connections and networking through those channels. But and for right now I have Instagram. Oh, and I just realized I do have a Twitter, but I use it like once or twice a decade. So
well, and I think there's, especially for Facebook, I do think there's like security settings too, where you can like modify it, where people coming into your profile wouldn't be able to look into your profile or even add you or message you. So
yeah. I think you're correct, but I just didn't want to take a chance.
Oh yeah.
And who knows if I'll even have Instagram for very much longer. We'll see. I'll just kind of play it by ear, but, I was definitely like, oh, Facebook. I felt like everyone I was still connected to on Facebook, I was just hiding them from my newsfeed because I was so tired of like all the things that, like, you know what, this is just, it's too complex an issue to be discussed in a productive manner on social media. This should be a conversation in person, not from, you know, behind a computer screen. So, I have just found it a little bit more beneficial for me personally, just to disconnect. And for right now, I've got a couple things. Oh, I have a Reddit account, but nice. That's mostly for my Star Trek and baking and workout stuff. So
I do have to say, I heard of this really interesting scenario in this podcast about, again, boundaries. And I think the scenario was a female therapist and a male client, right? And they both were on this dating site. I don't know what it was, but a client clicked right on her or swiped right on the therapist that they're currently meeting with each other for services.
Oh my goodness.
And I'm just thinking, like, how do you handle that situation? But again, like, there's not much you could do, like, in her shoes about that. Cause again, what do you tell a therapist? Like, you can't go on dating sites anymore.
Yes. Yeah. Fortunately, I never have been, and I don't ever plan to be on any sort of dating app. So at least I won't have to worry about that part. I do wonder sometimes just about being particularly not guarded. I'm trying to think of what the most appropriate word would be. Just cautious about my interactions with male clients. Again, I am warm and approachable, but I hope that I would also be regarded very professionally too. And that's something some of my other cohort members have, you know, expressed thoughts about, and just not reservations, but concerns about how to make sure that that space in the counseling room is a safe place where there is no doubt about the professionalism of the therapist or the counselor and their role, strictly there to provide therapeutic services, counseling services. But it can be, you know, and I haven't started seeing clients yet, but I imagine it can be a difficult and complex thing to work through. And I have read of, in particular, female therapists being hit on by their male clients. And I imagine that would be very distressing. And I can only hope that if that situation arises for me, that I will handle it with like a lot of graciousness, but a lot of professionalism and a very keen desire to very strictly hold to that boundary and reinforce to the client that that would be, just because of the asymmetrical balance of power there, potentially, that how unethical it would be and such a violation for them too. But definitely a complex issue and a difficult one for them to work through. And I'm thankful that I have some more time before I start seeing clients so that I can learn more about how to deal with that should that arise. I always joke, well, I'm only getting older and more decrepit, so hopefully it's not even something that I have to worry about for much longer. But you never know. And having doctor's patients, you know, that arises also. But handling it and making sure that the person doesn't feel embarrassed or anything, and protecting their dignity also, but reinforcing that boundary and making sure that the counseling room is a very safe space to discuss those issues. But not going there and knowing that that is not part of the equation at all.
And again, supervision is going to be so important for interns to help deal with those issues as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I imagine so. I read one story of a woman who experienced that in one of her early sessions and was very blatantly hidden on by her client. And her supervisor actually advised her to just say, look, I sense that you are attracted to me and I just want to be very clear that nothing could ever happen, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And gosh, it sounds so mortifying and troubling to even think of, but it does happen. And it sounds like she and her supervisor handled it in a very professional way. And the client was still cared for throughout the process. But yeah, glad that I have a little extra time to learn from my amazing professors and PIs before I have to potentially think about dealing with something like that.
Well, and like you said earlier, openness is the key. And mm-hmm. regarding that dating site one, from what I heard, like the female therapist actually acknowledged that on the next session. So there's, again, two routes. You could be like, oh, just pretend not to see it and don't say anything. Or you can acknowledge it and be assertive. And she took the acknowledgement route and she said, hey, you know, I saw you on the dating site. I saw that you swiped right. You know, let's talk about it. Let's be open about it. Like, how did you feel that you saw a therapist on a dating site and you swiped right? Mm-hmm. So you do further exploration.
Okay. That sounds terrifying, but I'm sure that I will learn more about that. And man, it's the sort of thing that you just, or at least I just pray that it never even comes up, and it likely will, because, you know, this is just like the world that we're in, but, and it happens, but, I certainly hope that, like, if that happens, that I will be exceptionally gracious and professional and not allow my personal fears to override what is most beneficial for the client at all.
Absolutely. And now that we're kind of winding down, I have to ask you something right now. If you were to give anyone special advice, anyone like in your shoes contemplating a second career, what type of inspiration would you give them?
Ooh, inspiring words. Okay. So I would say that regardless of circumstances, gosh, there has to be a way to find a way to do it. Like, I had three small children, and in many ways I have a lot of resources and privileges that other people do not. So I also don't want to be naive about that, but I would also say, do not allow your personal circumstances to discourage you from pursuing it, if it is at all a possibility. And, there are so many avenues to explore, and it's definitely, if it's something that weighs on you to help other people, to help other people care for their mental well-being, to press into those issues in mental health and, work with people in that capacity, whatever your life circumstances are, it can't hurt to just try it and pursue it. And again, I really want to stress that I am fully aware that I have so much that a lot of people don't. And so I don't want to minimize that. Like, I have it very easy in many ways, but I also would urge people to really try with every ounce of their being. If it's something that they're interested in, if they're passionate about, make every effort to make it happen. And because it is something that has been an incredibly rewarding experience for me. And I just love the idea of being able to help other people and give back to the community in this way. And we need people working in mental health from all backgrounds and all ages and all lifestyles, and we need that. So I highly encourage people to pursue it if it's something that they're interested in.
Very well said. Amen. Now, if any of my listeners do want to get a hold of you for some advice or just to vent about grad school or whatnot, is there an email that they could use to get a hold of you, or a LinkedIn account or whatnot?
Yeah, LinkedIn or email is fine. My LinkedIn, I think, is just linkedin.com/AELSTUARTAELStuart. And then the email account that I check most frequently is AELSTUART@gmail.com. So AELStuart for both. It's kind of my go-to.
Excellent. Well, again, thank you so much for being on the show. I greatly appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I really enjoyed being here.
I just want to give a special thanks to Amy Stuart for an awesome episode and for being an awesome guest. I also want to thank my BHI listeners for all their support. I again just want to inform everyone that the information expressed in this episode was not meant to be taken as therapeutic advice. But if you do find yourself going through any type of mental health or addiction issues, please seek the care of a licensed medical doctor or a licensed mental health therapist. All right, everyone. Thank you and have a good night. Bye.